Thank you so much for the introduction to synoptic sampling, because it makes my introduction a lot easier. I'd like to start first by acknowledging those that I worked with for their great help and for the funding. Last summer in 2016, there was a large algal bloom in north central Utah here at Utah Lake. You can see public interest peaked quite a bit in that time. While Utah Lake is important, it might not, for the purposes of my talk, be as important as the reservoir you see in the top left. This is the Deer Creek Reservoir, and that supplies most of the municipal water to the Wasatch Front and a large percentage of Utah's population. This here is the Walsburg watershed. It's about 180 square kilometers. You see the major tributaries here highlighted, and it supplies some of the water to the reservoir, but it also supplies a disproportionately high amount of the total annual phosphorus load. So what do you do in this case when, as was mentioned before, you have discharge information, but you can't say much about where in the watershed the phosphorus is coming from? What forms does it take? When is it being released? When is it being mobilized? And so that's why what I'll be presenting today focuses on a synoptic sampling approach, getting that spatial component while also looking at temporal and chemical changes in the landscape. So it'll be a bit more of a summary. So yes, again, these are the questions I was trying to answer. So as was mentioned just recently, with synoptic sampling, you get that spatially intensive snapshot. But one thing I noticed reading different examples of it being used is it's not often repeated temporally, and it's not often used to look at multiple forms of a constituent, usually just a total or maybe usually just a dissolved form. For instance, it's used a lot in mine drainage in the western United States to monitor for heavy metals. But could the same be applied to phosphorus? And so in addition to like a traditional synoptic sampling approach where you go at one time during base flow conditions, you know, what happens if you repeat it during higher flow periods of snowmelt? Or what happens if you repeat it at peak flow periods in the early spring? And what happens if you look at multiple forms of phosphorus? So in deciding when to sample, we first looked at 30 years of discharge data, and we chose three periods, the first of which is what I'll call rise in this presentation, and it occurs in about February or March. And this is characterized by low elevation snowmelt. The soils are saturated in the lower agricultural parts of the watershed. There's a greater potential for surface runoff, and there is some livestock grazing there. The next period we wanted to sample in was during the peak flow period of approximately May. Now, of course, I mean, there could be some climatic variation from year to year, but just going off of historical data, we chose to sample the 1st of May. This is characterized historically by higher flows, and you also see a lot of diversions being put into effect, changes in land use. And then the last period in which we sampled was during the traditional base flow conditions of late summer. In Utah, at least, in the western United States, there's very minimal rain, if any. Water levels drop considerably. Concentrations could go up with a lower dilution. And so these are the sites. And as was mentioned earlier, there's a density. And so we're trying to cover a large area, right, and balance how many sites can we get to, you know, in a short amount of time. So we repeated our sampling in the rise, peak, and base flow periods of 2015 and 2016 to try to average it together and account for climatic variation. The samples were brought back the same day and analyzed colorimetrically and on the ICP for these three fractions. But then with these three, we could estimate two other fractions being particulate phosphorus as well as dissolved organic phosphorus, which we're assuming to be the generally less reactive portion of dissolved. So with that, I'll try to walk you through just kind of a summary of our results. So one way to look at this is spatially, right? We've got, this is the base flow conditions, and we can see, you know, areas in which, you know, load increased in part due to increases perhaps of flow, but also due to increases in concentration. We see even in the upper watershed coming out of the forested areas, we see some potentially high loads. But of course this is all relative, right? It's just one point in time, and it leaves us with a lot of questions. Well, were these observations representative? What would happen in higher flow periods? We've only analyzed total phosphorus in the traditional sense, so what can we say about the forms and the sources and the pathways? Not much, right? So the next component was to layer in, let's open it up to looking at total phosphorus, but at a temporal time scale. And now all of a sudden we get a lot more information about the when and where phosphorus is being flushed out of the watershed. For instance, during the period of low elevation snowmelt, this lower portion is very hydrologically active, and we see a lot of phosphorus mobility. Concentrations tended to go up as well as flow. As we would expect during the springtime snowmelt period of the higher elevations, now we're seeing flushes of phosphorus come out of the forested areas. And we're also starting to see the effects of diversions here in the agricultural areas as water is being pulled out of the field or diverted for different purposes. So there's, again, more information that can be gained here. Another way to look at this is through the spatial profile, which was shown earlier. So from left to right, we have our sites as we move downstream. The top chart shows the rise period, the middle chart shows the peak period, and the bottom chart shows the base flow period with load on the y-axis. And if you'll notice, the scales are different. I was trying to deceive you. No, this was done intentionally because I'm really just interested in the patterns. We know that the loads are going to be different, right? More water, more phosphorus being mobilized. But are the same sites showing, are the same areas between, for instance, site 7 and 8, are they showing increases between those sites in every single flow period? Or take a site like Mean Creek 1, which is higher up in the forested areas, we really only see a significant load during the springtime peak snowmelt period. So now we're starting to get some understanding of phosphorus dynamics in our watershed over time, but we lack that the information that comes with chemical separation. So this is just, I don't know how well you can see that in the back, but now we're looking at all fractions of phosphorus at different times of the year, both spatially and chemically. And this is kind of where the synoptic sampling method comes into its own, being able to pair this kind of information with what you know about the land use in the watershed, what you know about the hydrology at the time. For instance, if we simplify and just go down to looking at the longitudinal profile of Main Creek again during the rise, peak, and base flow periods as we saw before, but now it's split out into fractions of phosphorus with particulate bound phosphorus in the black at the top, followed by dissolved reactive in the middle and dissolved organic in the light gray towards the bottom for each of the flow periods. So this allowed us to go through and look at the data, look where these fractions maybe were flow driven, where they were source driven as their concentrations went up. And I also looked at just the proportion, right? So let's ignore the magnitude. We know the magnitudes are going to be different during the high flow periods compared to the base flow periods. But if we look at the proportions, some really interesting information came out. For instance, dissolved reactive phosphorus didn't really appear in our water samples until about midway through the agricultural area of our watershed. We didn't see it coming out of the forested catchments, and that's something to learn, something to aid in the assessment of water quality. Likewise, we see certain areas of the watershed that show increases, for instance, in base flow, this area seems to show increases in particulate bound phosphorus, which you would think in base flow conditions with less water, this might not be the case, but perhaps it suggests something about stream bank stability or overland flow. if any. So one of the interesting observations, again, was about this dissolved reactive phosphorus really only appearing towards midway through the agricultural area. And so we looked a little bit more at this tributary to Main Creek called Spring Creek. And if we do the same kind of assessment, what's interesting to know is that the load is pretty constant year-round, and this is because this tributary is entirely groundwater-driven. And you know, which simplifies things a bit. We don't have to worry about so much overland flow and runoff as much because it's groundwater-driven. And we also notice, looking here at these proportions, that the water coming out of the ground is mostly dissolved reactive phosphorus, and the concentrations turn out to be right around the TMDL limit that Utah has set for dissolved phosphorus. Wouldn't that be useful information to know for planners, that the background levels of phosphorus are, you know, to what degree are they present, to what forms do they take? And I don't expect you to read this, it's just demonstrating again, these are some of the conclusions we felt like we could make from our assessment. This is more specific to our watershed, but in the broad sense, as we added a temporal component and as we added that chemical component, our ability to make conclusions and to assess the spatial and temporal dynamics of our watershed really increased. I think looking forward, what this sets us up to do is, you know, when you have a watershed that you're not really sure where phosphorus sources are and what forms they take, this kind of approach can narrow it down considerably. There are certain parts of our watershed that we were more interested in, and perhaps this suggests that future assessments could be much more targeted. We don't have to worry about the whole watershed. We could just look at the areas that consistently showed increases in phosphorus, maybe do some higher resolution DEM modeling to look at hydrology or to work more with stream bank assessment to see if there are any destabilized stream banks that could receive attention. But that's basically what I wanted to present to you. So thank you. Right. Yeah. So again, we tried our best to balance getting a high enough number of sites, but also covering it in a relatively short time, so we wouldn't worry about diode fluctuations. That's why we used two teams. So we were usually able to get it all done within 2 hours, and I really tried to make sure that we sampled at the same time every time we went, every year we went. So it was usually between like 9 a.m. and 11 a.m. So that way we weren't dragging our feet all day and into the afternoon kind of a thing. And we did do like a quick little exploratory study where we had an auto sampler set up to sample every hour for 24 hours to see if there could be some diode fluctuations, and there was some potential there certainly as phosphorus cycles within the stream in that period. But so that's why we try to limit our sampling to within like 2 hours every morning that we went out.
I noticed in one of your samplings that all of the phosphorus was particulate phosphorus and found most of this. How do you, there's no soluble phosphorus, and whether the source is always particulate phosphorus?
Yeah, you're talking about this here.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so, in a way, this was during baseball conditions, so it was very little water as there was. But that's something that I thought was very interesting. This forested catchment, we just never really measured any dissolved reactive phosphorus in those water samples, which was interesting. There was a big flush of dissolved organic in the during the snowmelt period, which might suggest certain things about snow interactions with organic phosphorus in the surface and near surface soils. But to only measure or to not really detect dissolved phosphorus. It was mostly, I guess, below detection limit. So there's that caveat too that these fractions might represent fractions that are below detection limit, and so they kind of get left out.